This is Changemakers with Katie Gore, finding the right solutions for the affordable housing community.
This week's changemaker is Sunny Shaw, the executive director of Southern Idaho's Twin Falls and Jerome Housing Authorities. Sunny has spent over 20 years in the affordable housing industry and has previously served as the National NARO president. She's also a certified professional career coach. Sunny, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Katie. It's wonderful to be here with you today.
Several years ago, I was at an industry event where you were super open and honest about your own struggles with affordable housing. Would you mind sharing that story with us?
Yeah, so I tell folks that, you know, my affordable housing journey is part of my why. It's the reason I get up in the morning. And my why actually started back when I was 2 years old. And it is a very personal story, about a single mother with a two-year-old who didn't have the options of affordable housing to make in her community. And she was trying to get by on her own with this child. And, you know, she ended up making a really sad decision and she took her own life, leaving that two-year-old behind. And I was that two-year-old, actually. And so I went to live with my maternal grandparents. And, you know, because they had lost a child, that family spiraled into addiction and depression. And so although my family, my parents both worked, I call them my parents because they, in the long run, ended up adopting me. But because they both, although they both worked, it was because of depression and addiction that our family lived very much paycheck to paycheck. And I can remember as a little girl when I would see the pink paper in the window of an electric bill, and I would know that that meant I needed to get an adult's attention so that we would be able to continue to have our lights and our heat. So then housing was incredibly important. And that leads to that first day I walked into a housing authority. You have to keep in mind that I started at the front desk of a housing authority answering the phones, but it felt like home. Because when I saw those children coming into our office, I knew that because of the work that we did day in and day out, whether their families thanked us or not, that those little babies had a roof over their head. And so that was my why, making sure that all of the kids in our country have a roof over their head. So I started as a receptionist and I worked my way up and ended up being, a case manager and then a branch office supervisor. And ultimately I went to another agency to become an executive director. My supervisor at the time encouraged me greatly. And she said, an executive director is really nothing more than a case manager on steroids. And I learned very quickly how strong that dose of steroids was. Being an executive director of an agency is all things at that agency. But that passion and that commitment, that why, is still what drives me. Still to this day, I tell my team, you may not get thanked today. In fact, you may get yelled at today. But because of the work you're doing, hundreds of children in our community have roofs over their head. And that matters. So on their behalf, I thank you. I thank you for your hard work each day. And so, Katie, that's part of that personal journey. Along the way, I did realize that my education needed to be beefed up a little bit. So I went back to school and got a bachelor's degree. It was a multidisciplinary degree that I shaped into the things that I thought I needed for housing specifically. It focuses on sociology, of course, business marketing and business management in general. And I intertwined a little bit of criminal justice into that because a lot of housing does dive into some of the criminal justice issues. So I was able to get that degree and graduate in 2016. So it really wasn't that long ago. I was actually an executive director as I was working on that degree. I now run two small agencies in Idaho. They are the Twin Falls and the Jerome Housing Authorities. They are both small. And recently, the Twin Falls Housing Authority was awarded the MTW Award in the expansion cohort for asset building. So we are super excited to be exploring our opportunities through moving to work. And then on a side note, I also do some consulting and go in and work with agencies, boards, and with leadership teams, as well as one-on-one career development. So I tend to keep myself pretty busy.
That is a lot. And I want to break up several of those pieces. I want to talk about Twin Falls and Jerome and the moving to work designation. But just looping back here, thank you for sharing your personal life story or your personal life, you know, how housing impacted you or lack of housing. It's an interesting piece about you, but there's also so many correlations to housing instability and just trauma-informed decision-making. So maybe walk us through a piece of that.
Yeah, I would love to do that. So, you know, I didn't include the full story, obviously, when I was sharing my personal journey. I mean, but I think that some of those things are what helped me to become the person I am and have the passion that I have. Until I was 9 years old, we lived in railroad housing. And so we had an outhouse and our bathtub hung on the side of our house right as people came into town. And I remember walking outside, you know, to use the outhouse and just being horrified as we would be waving to people coming into town. And, you know, I never had grand ambitions of, you know, being a millionaire or anything like that, but just knowing that I wanted a home that was stable, could not be taken away from my family as that railroad house eventually was, and that I, you know, that I could just call home. I thought that we had hit the lottery when we moved uptown into a single wide trailer because it had two bathrooms. But that insecurity, and you did use the word trauma. I think that when someone can come through trauma and still have a positive outlook, then they can utilize that experience of trauma to relate to others who are in that position currently. I like to believe that I have a very deep level of empathy, and we need that in our work. We need to understand that the family sitting across from us, oftentimes society says they just made bad choices. Maybe it's not about their choices. Maybe it's just how life turned out. You know, as a two-year-old, I didn't make bad choices. That was just how life turned out. And so it's up to us to be able to provide people a path. And when I think of what was the backbone of the resilience was this unending hope that things could be better. I knew I was loved despite my parents' addiction and depression. I knew that they loved me and were doing the very best they could. And as a result, I ended up feeling very responsible for them. And I grew up into an adult who takes responsibility for almost everyone around me. And so I guess that's the resilience is hope and recognizing that if something was going to happen to change my situation, I had to be the one to do it. But I'm incredibly grateful that in that journey, I didn't lose the compassion and I didn't forget where I came from, because I think it lends to the families that I serve being able to connect with me and knowing that I care, because at the end of the day, if we don't share that we care, then why did we even try? And so I think it's based on my resiliency is based on the hope and understanding that my future was really up to me.
It's interesting, this resilience and this hope, it doesn't come from a Pollyanna state, but quite the contrary, it comes from a recognition and acceptance, but then now you've uniquely paired it with compassion and empathy. What a fascinating, you know, molding of who you are. And I'm sure that translates into how you lead now, correct?
I would certainly hope so. Even, you know, my team, my residents, my community, everything that I take on as a leader, I hope that I come from the approach of compassion and really, really caring about the people that I'm engaging with.
So I'm sure it's hard because life is hard, but I'm also sure it's hard because when you want to try to put in accountability, how do you layer that maybe with your staff or with people in your programs, and yet understanding life is hard and choices are difficult and circumstances are unique? You know, what's the accountability piece and how you will do lease enforcement or staff accountability and performance outcomes?
So lease enforcement, first of all, I always remember that as a housing authority, we are actually in the business to say yes. We are not in the business to say no. And so my first approach is when I recognize that there's some sort of spiraling happening that is causing some lease violations, I like to have that household in. I like to have a conversation with them and create a plan of how they're going to be successful. If they're not following my plan and we have a second issue, then I'm going to have them sign a document that they understand that if they violate that issue again, that I'll have no option except for to ask them to leave. And they sign that they understand that. But then I work to also put them in touch with services that can help us to overcome those issues. We're lucky we have the resident opportunities and service coordinators grant program here. And so we can really utilize different services that housing authorities have to be able to ensure that families don't become homeless. Now, Katie, when a family has to move on, they have to move on. Because at the end of the day, there's a couple of things I have to remember. I run a business and I'm responsible for that business. And second of all, I have to make sure that the other households that are neighbors are safe and seeing that we uphold the lease. I take the approach of what you say in words. Yes, it matters how you know, the words you use, but what matters more is how you say it and being able to have those candid and difficult conversations so that folks can understand that you aren't being mean to them, that this is a consequence for an action and you've been trying to help them overcome that action. It's the same with my team. I really believe that leadership in action has compassion attached to it. I don't dictate. I've never raised my voice to a team member. I don't believe in raising my voice. It's highly unprofessional and inappropriate. And even if someone raises their voice at me, I say, you know what? I think we should finish for today. You can go on home and think about it. And we'll come back tomorrow when you're ready to talk. And so I really try to take an approach of how that other person is feeling in that moment and how I can help bridge the gap from how they're feeling and how that accountability can be recognized.
Interesting. It's such a creative blend of both your personal and your professional world, and then also this compliance and making sure the business is at hand and working smoothly. So it's a great continuum that I think many people should hear, because it's not all compassion without accountability, but yet it's not all compliance and accountability without compassion. So great job in achieving that balance.
I still work on it every day, but that's always my goal. But I can promise you, I have never yelled at someone, a resident or team member.
It's one of those things that you shouldn't have to be able to say, but so many times people are desperate with their housing situation and they are accelerated in their conveying of the facts or the situation. And we do have to constantly remind our staff and our teams to say, you have to understand where they are in this moment, even though they may be expressing quite loudly. It's important for, you know, the people who are serving, who are on the front lines, who are in the units, who are walking the property, who are handling them on the waiting list, to know the context by which what is truly driving them and their urgency. You know, speaking of waiting lists, let's transition here and talk about Idaho and what are the market dynamics? What's the housing need? Give us a glimpse of what's going on out in your area.
We have, like the rest of the country, an incredible housing shortage. I think every meeting I attend, we talk about that with the county commissioners, with the city, with our community partners. We talk about this housing crisis that we recognize we're not alone in, that the country is in. We have had a lot of folks move into our state who are from neighboring states and have bought up a lot of real estate sight unseen for huge amounts of money. So that has driven our purchasing properties up dramatically, which sadly has taken those first-time home buyers and put them more permanently in the rental market. And we know for a fact that when those first-time home buyers move on to home ownership, that frees up units in the market. So without that happening, we are seeing compression all the way down to the families that we serve. And so it's making units that would be considered, you know, using the air quotes, affordable, less available for those families to be able to find. We went from a one bedroom that 2-3 years ago rented for $450 a month. A one bedroom now is up at $900 a month. Now I recognize that for other more populated areas of the country, gosh, $900 may not be a lot. But when you consider it was $450 before, for a single individual or a couple to be renting, the market dynamic has changed incredibly. We have added new units to the community, but just not enough, just not enough. And we're seeing folks who can no longer keep up with their property taxes. So we may be seeing even some homeowners displaced because they've, with the rising property prices, those taxes have gone up as well. So we can see that we're in a real pandemic here. And my homeless coalition, of which I'm a part of, it's a really sad state. We used to talk about homeless in the shelters or homeless individuals and where they were living. Now we're talking about families with children sleeping in their cars, and where can we find places that they can be safe sleeping in their car? I think it's a tragic day. It almost feels like giving up on the creating more housing and like, gee, which parking lots have you heard are the safest? And we're talking about babies, you know, doing their homework in these cars. And so what's happening in Idaho is very similar to what's happening in the rest of the country. Of course, the dollar numbers we talk about are proportional based on where you live, but it's no less a crisis here. And even in rural Twin Falls and Jerome, it's just a shocking crisis. And you talk about wait lists, you know, for our 2-bedroom wait list, we are at a 2-to-3-year wait, which is incredible. And that's in our public housing. And I think that that's sometimes why we get that we had talked about previously, the frustration and the upset and anger that people who are coming in to apply for our programs, how they feel, because we're probably the fifth agency of the day that's used the words wait list. We just sound so bureaucratic. That's the business we run. But the housing situation in Idaho is tragic, without question.
I've even heard it called wait list fatigue. And, you know, there it's a reflection of, yes, the lack of supply and the increased demand, but there's also the human component of, like you said, the fifth agency that they're in line and they're being told the same thing, you know, 2-to-3-year waiting list or nothing available, but yet they need it now.
Yes.
Are there any housing programs that provide it now?
In Twin Falls, Idaho, we have a shelter that is transitional housing. It's been full for the last 2 years. So there isn't anyone that provides it now. And it is waitlist fatigue. I know of a young woman with a disabled daughter. I've been trying to get her to apply for 6 months. But as soon as we start talking about how long it will be, you know, she just gets discouraged and doesn't. And I think the time's going to pass anyway, but she hears that time frame and she's like, why even bother? Why try? I am tired of trying and never getting any response or moving forward. So it is a waitlist fatigue that folks are having. And finally, to address some of the homelessness issues that we have in the area, our homeless coalition, there's 4 of us that have been working on cold weather shelter so that at night, at least, folks can have a place to get out of the cold weather and come and be safe. So we're hoping that that will have an impact, but there's no place for them, Katie. There is no place for them that is emergency shelter right now. Agencies do what they can. They may have a hotel voucher for a couple of days, but they're not going to have anything for longer than that. And it is cold in Idaho. So it is a tragedy right now.
Are there programs that are helping you try to attract new development in your area for new construction?
Yes, at least we're trying to attract those programs. We did a story for the newspaper a few weeks back, and even just since that newspaper was ran, I've gotten several cards from developers across the country who are interested in working with us. I know that if we could begin the process, that we would be able to get some of the money that goes to our finance agency, you know, even if it was a 4% tax credit and maybe some home dollars, that we could do something with that. Where the Twin Falls and Jerome housing authorities have been handcuffed is that both agencies are public housing only. And so, as you know, with public housing, those dollars are restricted. All of the dollars you get through public housing, you can't use to develop something new. That's why the MTW designation for Twin Falls was such exciting news for all of us, because we recognize that now some of the funds that we get, you know, so long as we're helping the same number of people and we're still, our properties are still doing great, then we can use some of those funds for development. So that was really good news to us. The two agencies have also come together recently and created a nonprofit that they hope to be able to apply for grants and utilize other opportunities for funding to be able to develop. And so it represents the two agencies together. It's called the Hope Foundation of Idaho. And so we are hoping to be able to develop out of that nonprofit as well.
You just mentioned Twin Falls was recently granted a moving to work designation from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Great job. And you started to explain what this designation means for you. So let's brainstorm and dream here. I know as fast as you can build it, you can lease it. So how do you envision this taking fold over the next few years?
So yes, we are so excited. One of the things that we're going to do that is not necessarily tied to MTW, but it will help us with some of those dollars. We are currently looking at green space. One thing public housing is notorious for is a lot of green space. And so long as it does not impact the life of the tenants, you know, meaning basically they're not using it that much, and you can make a justification for its release, you can petition HUD for a dispo of that green space from the Declaration of Trust, and so that we could take it into ownership ourselves. So we are looking at a stretch of grass that we have that's on the backside of a property and having it be removed from our Declaration of Trust, our DOT. And we've been working with the city at looking at how we can put, I use the word tiny homes. I think everyone else in the world uses accessory dwelling units or something along that line. But we want to put 4 or 5 tiny homes on it. The city has said that it's possible, targeting the market of individuals who are new in the workforce, your barista, your person who works at McDonald's, the folks who can't quite afford to move out of mom and dad's house, but want some independence. We think that's a great start. And then if we are able to pilot those 4 or 5 units and do well with those, we would like to expand on that. We think it makes a lot of sense, especially recognizing that we are seeing a generation who don't believe they need a 5 or 6 bedroom home. We're seeing a generation that are fine with a really lovely studio or a 1 bedroom. So we would like to see how this pilot goes and then be able to utilize MTW funds as we expand that some more. And then also we're looking at some affordable complexes that we would like to build and or trailer courts if we hear that they're in jeopardy of being bought and evicting all of those residents out of the property, which has happened a few times in our valley, then we would like to be able to pull the funds together to purchase those trailer courts, of course, do upgrades, but be able to make sure that the families that live there are still promised long-term housing. So I think there are so many things that we can do with those cuffs kind of unlocked and taken off of our wrists. And that's just kind of me like starting to dream, right? So those are some of the things I've been thinking about when I can't sleep at night.
I like what you've described, because you're really showing that the affordable housing problem isn't going to be solved by just one model. You're really tailoring it to new workforce housing with smaller units, you know, green space utilization, sustainability, and then also trying to look at all of these different things from even preservation of what you currently have. So what a great blend to solve a much larger problem.
It kind of feels like, especially with the MTW designation, like the world is full of opportunity. Until we've gotten that designation, we felt like our only way forward was this nonprofit. But now we feel that we have a couple of opportunities to move forward. And we are really looking forward to impacting our community.
That's great. Well, hold on, Sunny. We need to stop here, but coming up in the second part of my talk with Sunny Shaw, the Executive Director of Southern Idaho's Twin Falls and Jerome Housing Authority, Sunny shares what she believes some housing leaders might be missing.
I think that's the thing that employers are missing or housers are missing is our deep responsibility to bring others with us, not just to sit on the throne by ourselves, but to make sure there's plenty of chairs at the table and bring others with us.
Thanks for listening to Changemakers with Katie Gore. To find out more about Katie, go to quadel.com. That's QUADEL.com. This has been a production of Forbes Books Radio.